session of April 27, 1977. It's the penultimate session. Next meeting will be May 4th, last class. A few people gave me some questions. If they want to come and see me at the end of the class. Today we'll talk about the last two issues. One is dirt, dirtiness, and the foreign. It's a prosaic figure, dirtiness. In two works of our corpus, we have the question of excrement, of dirt and dirtiness. The Oriental monks, that variety known as the stylites, we met them several times. And then Gilles confined woman of Poitiers. First, I'd like to say that we have to think of what is notable. Since Freud, we've become used to assigning, we find it natural, a certain meaning to excrement, to making it take a place within a symbolic system. Literature, that's always ahead of everything else, has known a fair amount about excrement. The language of scatology irrigates a number of great works. If you're interested, take a look at Norman Brown's book, Eros and Thanatos, published 12 years ago. The second half of the book discusses the literary theme of excrement. Before we postulate meanings on the level of a corpus, since excrement or dirtiness is one of the repressions of social life, or something that is repressed, we have to see that these objects are noteworthy. Before being assigned a meaning, excrement is noted as an event. In structural terms, it's a marked term. In the semantics of discourse, it's not a degree zero. To speak of something is to give it a meaning before any content is given. If I put it in a sentence, it has a certain meaning. At the level of our corpus, I will indicate some of the ways in which excrement becomes an event. First, when it is the object of an intensive marker, it's the excess of dirtiness that makes us notice it and want to describe it. with respect to what norm? At what point is a space considered dirty? When is dirt noted or notable? What would be an historical account of filth? As one could imagine, a history of tears. The body is a historical object. We lack a history of bodies. Especially the French school of the Annales. I haven't seen any history of tears or history of dirt. In the Confined Woman of Poitiers, we have descriptions that are insistent in the police reports. The bedroom in which Mélanie lives is polluted. The police reports know the filth, the pollution. There are insects, rodents feeding of the excrement on the bed. There are remains of meat, rotten straw mattress, everything is encrusted with excrement. Vegetables, fish, rotting bread, oyster shells. Such a foul odor when the bedroom was discovered that the doctors and the policemen gave permission to smoke. I note that what interests me. This is a definition of excess. Excess is a notion that structural methodology finds difficult to define, to get a handle on. This methodology doesn't know quantity. Cannot discuss variations in quantity. Structural analysis is yes, no, not quantity. Here, the structural functioning can see that there is a new behavior that is marked. There is such an excess that the police allow for smoking. The law is obliged to authorize the infraction. It marks the excess of dirtiness. Excess of bad smell. A second manner of marking excess is the intensely meaningful lifting of the general suppression of excrement. Daniel, the stylite, in the context of his history, of his ardent faith, of his intense spirituality, of his sublimation, of his purity. It's a theme of hagiography. The saint's body is a glorious body. What's a glorious body? It's a technical term in theology.
Le corps glorieux, c'est un corps qui précisément n'a pas de besoin
It's a body that doesn't shit, purified of evacuation of any excremental function. It's an eternal body already in heaven. There are countless anecdotes about saints' bodies being intact when their coffins are reopened. No putrefaction. What's interesting is that Daniel recognizes the human nature of his body. He embodies this variety of a saint like everyone else, a saint playing at being a man like you and me. He was on top of his column. The disciples would ask, and he would answer, "Believe me, brother, I eat and drink as much as I need to. I'm not a pure spirit. I'm not disincarnate. I am a man and clothed in flesh. As for that other necessity, that of shitting, my turds are like a goat's due to my extreme dehydration." The excess is an event. It's from there that we can open the dossier of excrement, of dirt. We can find that in our corpus. First of all, with the confined woman of Poitiers, let's go back to the ethological notion of territory. There are territorial animals, deer, hippopotamus, man. Now, a territory can be marked out intentionally, meaningfully, with excrement. This is the case of the hippopotamus. Near the river in which he marks his territory by excrement. In comparative biology, there is the notion of an odorous space. It fills the three dimension in which a smell is active. Animal territory coincides with the odorous space. Smell is linked through the process by which a territory is demarcated. The identification of neighboring territories of appropriation relies on that. Dogs in the street, they less and less, they investigate each other's territories. In an already well-watered tire, every dog will overmark his territory. Smells in the animal world are a struggle between signs, the victory over one another. All ethologists have worked on this idea of struggle, also sexual attraction. There is an invitation to enter another's territory, territory is connected with mating. The excrement is here the origin of odor. You find this in sexual seduction. If the confined woman of Poitiers, there's an accumulation of powerful smells. They reinforce her territory. She called this the grotto, the great back malampia. There is then an appropriation. Second meaning, smell implies secession, separation. The studite monks from the Studios monastery near Constantinople had a rule never to wash. It was not, as one could believe, a form of mortification to the men that they had renounced the world's habits. As we've seen, dirt functions as an anti-norm, anti-pollution. Hygiene and property could be seen as a pollution, but here you refuse the pollution of society and you set yourself apart from society. To be dirty is a separation from the world. Third sense, intimacy, to be taken here in the very strong sense, the profound essence of the family, intimus, is the superlative, the innermost. Interior would be the comparative. Intimus is a very strong state. We have many anecdotes that can be baroque. The family of Mélanie in Poitiers, Bastien, as a genotype, they are characterized by two traits, like hereditary features, a taste for reclusion and a taste for dirt. The grandfather was living as a recluse in his bedroom. He refused to leave it, even when his son-in-law died in the room next door. The house of the Bastians was closed to visitors. The mother received her two visitors on Saturday afternoons so that she could spend the rest of the week in a dressing gown. Then the fondness for filth. We find this even more singular, noteworthy. What is noteworthy? We see this not only with Mélanie, but with a brother. The brother displayed all the classic traits of perversion, of scatophilia. It was a true case in the Kraftebin vein. For instance, the brother didn't want his sheets to be changed. In the bedroom, he had several handful slop pails. In the middle of the room, an overbrimming chamber pot. He would take the pot into the kitchen while the cook was eating. He would put his chamber pot next to his wife's bed so she might get a good whiff of the odor. The brother visited his sister every day in the room we have seen described. It would last for a while. He would sit at the window reading the Journal de Vienne. He was never bothered by the stench. Yet dirtiness is shared as a sign of family. The community of intimo, the collective intimacy, again, the idea of a territory. Finally, fourth, of course, excrement takes on the meaning of its counterpart, education, toilet training, the noble function. The education here is a function that Freud explored. It's been endowed with a whole parade of symbolic transformations. In our corpus is the ruling of society over excrement. It's represented by the hospital, but the nuns, well, Melanie is taken after she has been wrenched away from a grotto. In the hospital, before she would soil herself, and she goes on to relieve herself in bed. Slowly, she learns. The nuns are well pleased. Society has saved Melanie. I'd like to finish this with another notion, which I will call tact, delicacy. Nature is not clean. It's neither clean nor dirty. Behaviors relating to cleanliness are invested with a mass of symbolic and cultural values, of ideological alibis. Cleanliness has become nature as the natural in our society. There is a tendency in society to assimilate technological progress to nature, to what transforms technological progress in nature. But the subject can easily divide up that mass of the natural. They can be clean in one way, dirty in another. They choose on the basis of a complex economy. Two features. Melanie, as we've seen, is a paragon of dirtiness, and in spite of that, after all the features we've seen, she surprises the interns at the Hôtel Dieu in the hospital. She astonishes them because before touching a meal, she asks, "Is this clean?" Of course, she eats with her fingers, but as the interns note, with great delicacy. She keeps orange pips in the hollow of her hand until someone comes to take them away. Second observation, it's about the question of dirtiness, on a matter of dirty linen, that Sade formulated the principle of tact in a letter to his wife.
Avait demandé au marquis qui était prisonnier
he was in jail, the Marquess had asked whether she could clean his dirty linen. Sade pretends not to see the actual literal request, and he writes, "Charming creature, you want my linen, my old linen? Do you know, that is complete tact. You see how I sense the value of things. Listen, my angel, I have every wish in the world to satisfy you in this matter. You know the respect I have for tastes, for fantasies. However baroque they might be, I find them all respectable. One is not the master of them. And because the most singular and bizarre of them, well examined, depends upon the principle of tact." Now, last figure. Last time, or next time rather, we will conclude that this is our last figure. This is the end of the list of figures. It's a Greek word. We started with another Greek word, Acedia. Now we will bring things to a close with a Greek notion and a Greek word. This word is xenitheia. Xenitheia. I will give you the semantic network. It has to be located within a network in which it finds a meaning of a value. To talk about the meaning of a word, we don't need to look at the dictionary. We need to take a look at the network of other words with a similar meaning. Xenitheia. Xenitheia is the key element of the ascetic doctrine of ancient Christian monachism. You guess the meaning. It comes from xenos, foreign.
Xenitheia
is the state of changing country, expatriation, voluntary exile. It would correspond to the Latin peregrinatio, from which you have pilgrim.
Peregrinatio
has a military origin. It is the period of time a mercenary spends in a foreign country. This makes me fantasize. Each of us could perhaps be defined as a mercenary in the world we have to operate in, working dispassionately in the service of various causes that are not our own, being perpetually dispatched by those causes into regions where we are foreigners. Xenitheia is that state of expatriation. Here are two equivalents. For Buddhist monks, the first stage of ordination, Pabbaja. It means exiting, leaving the prior condition behind, to leave behind a previous condition. Second equivalent, the commune movements in its beginnings in the US, there was this expression the dropouts. People who've dropped everything, who've quit the ranks, as opposed to drop in, those who fall in somewhere, who fit in. There may be, for some of us, a temptation to drop out. There's a recurrent temptation for that. It's a fantasy that corresponds to the religious ritual of getting rid of all your belongings, embracing poverty. We can find that in us. We minutely calculate how to get rid of everything. What is the minimum of objects we need to keep? It's a fantasy of putting your affairs in order. For instance, leaving for good to set up home in the countryside. We see the fantasy of the dropout. In the other, another point in the network is another term, stenocoria.
Stenocoria.
Stenos means a narrow path. Is the narrow path. It's a form of exile, like xenitheia, one that's so internal that the world barely notices it. It's an inner exile, an intelligence that's never divulged, a hidden life, where no one else knows about the goals I am pursuing, a refusal of glory, an abyss of silence. It corresponds very well to the narrow space of Tao. It's an unnoticed wisdom, the refusal of glory. One principle of the Tao is that you shouldn't be noticed. You shouldn't act wrongly, but you shouldn't act too well either. Neither too well nor too badly. I'll give you two other notions that are connected to Xeniteia. It's Tlilipsis, from the verb libo, to compress, to press down. It's opposed to Xeniteia, a trial. Xeniteia is forced to undergo. La lipsis is a rupture of Xeniteia. The tender feelings facing the world. A tender feeling for the world. You have this in all those ancient texts. Compassion for your father, for your mother, for children, the desire to have someone to love. This is lipsis. It's the good demon who returns in Xeniteia. It repatriates the world via tenderness. It has a connection with nostalgia. Homesickness for a return. A return to a specific space.
Dans la nostalgie. Je dis cela par opposition à cet autre mot très proche de nostalgie.
This is opposed to another word.
C'est le mal d'un retour infini et sans
the infinite return.
C'est un exil sans fantasme.
Exile.
Ça serait plutôt du côté de l'Acadie.
Which is closer to Acadia.
C'est un fantasme positif de rapatriement.
It's a positive fantasy of repatriation. Another term is paresia. P-A-R-R-E-S-I-A. Lipsis is the opposite of Xeniteia, but it involves the nobility of affect, of love, of tenderness. Paresia is the opposite without nobility. It's ungenerous. It's purely social, worldly. Xeniteia is a condition where there is no familiarity with other people, with things, with memory, with the world. Paresia is the idea of frankness, which is ease, familiarity, no embarrassment, lacking discretion. Someone who feels at home or among friends, wherever they are. Paresia is linked to a social excess of language, an arrogance of language, a will to appropriate through language, a will to grasp through language. For me, paresia is the dogmatic form of language. Every time I perceive a dogmatic form of language, I see paresia. Hence, its opposite meaning, Xeniteia. When a man is master of his own language, not other people's.
Et on peut dire qu'en ce sens, un exemple de Xeniteia merveilleux.
A marvelous example of Xeniteia is in Spinoza. In his life, we read this. He had the command of his anger, and if at any time he was uneasy in his mind, it did not appear outwardly. or if he happened to express his grief by some gestures or by some words, he never failed to retire immediately for fear of doing an unbecoming thing. There is a sort of worldly, something that's not a worldly conformity. It's a deep-rooted disposition. It consists in taking care of the others so as not to upset or irritate them. Paresia is unapologetic. Xenitheia is not, therefore, unrelated to good manners. It's the notion of politeness. It's not the politeness of the Western world, but the politeness of the Western world, of the Orient. I tried to describe this in Empire of Science. Talking about certain aspects of that morality called Bushido. This is the network, a portion of the network of Xenitheia. And I reach another problem. Once that Xenitheia has taken hold within a subject, there is an infinite dialectic. It is set in motion to make oneself Xenos. We'll meet dialectical problems here. There's the stenochoria, the radical effacement of what can look like, runs the risk of looking like seeming posturing in Xenitheia. To be Xenos in such a way that it goes unnoticed. This is the recurring problem in the debate, the struggle with the image. In order to undo or avoid having an image, it's necessary to construct a false counter-image. The problem of the image is that there's no degree zero of the image. I am in the world always endowed with an image. If I manage to realize a degree zero of image, if I was without an image, in some respect, I would accomplish Xenitheia itself. It's a term that is impossible to accomplish. For example, in the field of early Oriental Christianity, this is a problem. How to make oneself Xenos, making yourself foreign to the world without generating the image of what other people think of you. One becomes a foreigner to the world. If we want to escape from the consideration of man, it can involve trying to attract disdain and dishonor.
C'est là l'attitude, la conduite, le faire utile de l'accepter. Deux exemples.
Two examples.
Nous avons vu l'histoire de l'éponge.
We saw that in the story of the sponge.
Et le thème de se rendre fou.
Be a fool so that you may be wise.
Se rendre fou dans le monde pour être réellement sage, puisque le monde est fou.
If the world is foolish, by being foolish, you are wise. We find this in the Gospels and the Tao. The second story is from John of Ephesus, Lives of the Eastern Saints, the story of two people from Antioch, a man and a woman. They abandon everything. They lead an itinerant life. The man dresses as a mountebank, the woman as a courtesan. They live as brother and sister without any cares, and they conceal their life of prayer and abstinence from everyone. They feign madness. It's a form of Xenitheia. Abba Or, a monk from Nitria from the 4th century, writes, either free man for good or just with the world and mankind by regularly feigning madness. Give a false image, feigning madness. To conclude, Xenitheia is a certain experience of dereality. An experience of the reality that, as such, has an affinity with mystical and psychotic experiences. We have first to understand something that's complicated, the theme I have discussed in the Lover's Discourse, the opposition between unreality and dereality. It's an opposition that has been clarified by psychoanalysis, Lacan, in topological terms. It's not the same retreat from reality. First, to unrealize, I refuse reality of the world in the name of a fantasy. Everything around me changes value in relation to an imaginary. A common state is somebody who is in love and who unrealizes. Someone who is in love unrealizes the world, which irritates him, with respect to the image of the loved one, which is his reality. In this sense, to unrealize the world is to realize the peripeteias and utopias of love. To derealize is different. Here too, I lose reality, but there's no longer any substitution to compensate for that loss. I'm no longer even in the imaginary. When I unrealize, I am in the imaginary. When I derealize, I have lost the imaginary. I am not dreaming. The whole world is frozen, petrified, dull. In other words, unsubstitutable. There is the inability to substitute an image to another. To unrealize is the neurotic field, to derealize is the psychotic field. Someone who is in love will hesitate between the two. Most of the time he unrealizes the world, but at times he derealizes the world. These are the moments when the lover is mad, crazy, psychotic. In all likelihood, Xenitheia does the same. It hesitates between unreality, the investment in loving the divinity, and the reality, the absence of all fatherland or motherland, no reality at all. Therefore, Xenitheia can go as far as a form of inner depatriation. Mélanie is a good example of this radical form of Xenitheia. It's an inner exile. It's a sort of peregrinatio in Latin. She remains at the same spot. Mélanie practices this. She doesn't inhabit a name. The name is the supreme, ultimate fatherland. She doesn't have a name. The police asks her, is your name not Mélanie Bastien? She answers, there's more than one with that name. And it wasn't me who had so much hair, that was another one. There are others apart from myself who have the same name. She accepts or stands by what the world would define as total egoism. It's a theme from Tao. She says about everyone, that is, all the members of her family, she says about cousins, brothers, let him stay where he is, he's just fine. Or, too bad for her, too bad for everyone. To conclude, to say that there is within us Xenitheia. How to call it? It's a fantasy, maybe. A temptation of truth. It can take the shape of a double fantasy. There is first a sad or oppressive fantasy, feeling like a foreigner in your own country, within your social class, with none of the institutions into which you are classified. It's a very common problem. Every time I read Le Monde, I'm overcome with a fit of Xenitheia. It's the style of the newspaper. It's a violent feeling that I am totally foreign. A few times I had to write in that newspaper, and then anxiety took me of being a total foreigner to the French world of Le Monde. This Xenitheia can spread. It's quick spreading. It can fill the social space around the subject. Abba Pistos defines Xenitheia in the following way. What is Xenitheia? Be silent and say whatever the situation you happen to be in, I have got no business here. That's what Xeniteia is. I have to say that the first 10 minutes of my first class were a moment of Xeniteia. What are you doing here? That was my question. What are you doing there? I had it only for 10 minutes. It was marked by anxiety. It can be an active fantasy, a compulsion to get away at the moment a structure takes hold. Whether they are ideological or beliefs, whenever there is a network that functions, I can be seized by the wish to go elsewhere. This is what happens for monks. After years spent in a monastery, the monk was too easy in the routine and he had to become a foreigner again. That's the same when around us, even if we've contributed to it, there's a language, a doctrine, a movement of ideas, a set of positions that solidifies, crystallizes, becomes a compact mass of habits, complicities, facilities, in linguist terms, a socialect. We can experience the impulse of Xeniteia to go elsewhere, to live thus in a state of intellectual wandering. So we come back to the utopia of the effective group, the fantasy of the idiorhythmic community from which we started. Utopically, this fantasy, the idiorhythmic fantasy, would allow for a certain form of Xeniteia. A Xeniteia with respect to a common fatherland, or the great other, while sheltering the subjects from the anxiety of affective abandonment, of affective expatriation. Xeniteia. Without that tenderness that we have called clipsis. And if I had to give the final envoi to this figure, this debate between Xeniteia and clipsis, it would be a feature borrowed from conventional monastic life. As we know, monastic timing is very strictly regulated, both over the course of the year. The annual cycle is organized around Easter. Each year, it's the sacrist or cantor who decides on the calendar around Easter. There is also a strict timing for the 24 hours of the day. Lourdes, first light of the day. Prime, as the sun rises, end of the day, Vespers, in the medieval sense, when the sun was a sort of clock. As night falls, you have the comply, the office just before going to bed. I say to conclude that the idea of complying is beautiful. We have to go back to the time of the blooming of convent life. The community prepares to brave the night. The night that is scary. At that time, the night was fearful. Imagine to understand what is existentially necessary, a countryside far away from anywhere, with no lights, where nightfall really means the threat of darkness. Then you have the ritual singing of the community at compliant time to face obscurity, to confront the sadness of night together. Living together means this. Being together to face the night. Being among strangers is inevitable, necessary, even. Except when night falls.